Welcome to the third episode of Discourse, a first-person critique talk show where two architects with different takes on how to do good architecture come together and criticize each other's work in a constructive manner. I'm Tania Tobar Torres, architect, writer, and curator, and today I have the opportunity to introduce two architectural practices through the lens of criticism in architectural culture. The concepts of critique and crisis share a common etymological root in the Greek word krino, which means to judge, design, or distinguish. And its root suggests a process of separating and dividing to make a determination. So I would like to present this episode by framing the act of dismantling or disassembling a device, or in this case, the practice, as an approach not only to understand how it works, but also as a creative entity where new knowledge may appear. Under this logic, Chilean architecture editor Francisco Diaz reminded us recently at a panel in the Venice Architecture Biennale that some objects are nevertheless so hard to break, so hard to disassemble, like a stone, for instance, or in this case, the stone that is architecture, that one needs to apply extra pressure for a crack to appear. A tiny space that did not exist before the applying of said pressure. And that it is precisely that opening, that small space, that new space, what critique enables. So the question of how to dismantle it and where to apply this pressure becomes a practice of its own. And so other critical tools like publications and exhibitions or even the encounter in a podcast may introduce the art of taking things apart as a means to invite readers, visitors, and listeners to a way of engaging with the meticulous process of disentangling, of breaking down or examining conditions, ideals, and methods that responds to today's societal questions. Through conceptual and material experimentation, alternative tools and techniques, or the disruption of entrenched institutional hierarchies, we find ourselves envisioning new modes of architectural production. Central to this exploration is a commitment to inclusivity, diversity, transparency, and accountability. The act of undoing provides an opportunity to reconsider old assumptions, creating space for reimagined ways of making. And so, rather than prescribing a singular model, let us reflect upon the fragmented and layered context within which architecture operates, offering new possibilities for reassembly and experimentation. For through the act of bringing pieces back together, they expand how architecture can be practiced, taught, and understood in the present moment. This episode features Bangkok Tokyo Architecture and Cosmos Architects. Let us remember that the two basic rules for the discussion remain the same. Both participants should focus on the overall question of what could good architecture be. Each participant has sent the other three elements prior to the discussion. One, a built project. Two, a non-built project through photos, images, drawings, and text. And three, a text of their own authorship. For more information on the elements selected by each practice, visit the episode's description. And now, the Discord.
All right. Hi, my name is Watanya. I am the co-founder of Bangkok and Tokyo-based firm Bangkok Tokyo Architecture. I founded the office in 2017 with my partner, Takahiro. We're mainly based in Bangkok, and we also teach at universities here, as well as kind of run a small practice of, at the moment, six people, including us. And we do many types of projects, from small residential projects, temporary projects, and also medium-scale residential and commercial projects as well. And Leonard, maybe I can start talking about some of the elements that kind of I took from the kind of information you shared with us. I think I found a lot of interesting things that we actually share in common, especially coming from the context of Bangkok that we're living in at the moment. I maybe can start with the book and the text that you shared. I was specifically interested in kind of the idea of temporariness within cities and kind of you looking at different cultures and contexts. And I saw some of the images are actually images that are from Bangkok and Thailand as well. And you're looking at vernacularity and all the different elements and splitting that into different topics. I think I don't have perhaps like a very critical comment or how I would have done it differently at the moment. now, but I also have some questions. I think that I want to know kind of the process that went into making that text and sort of how you gathered the images and perhaps how you see, you know, where you are based as opposed to perhaps where we are based and how that book would have been or could be conveyed differently in different contexts and cultures, depending on, you know, the point or where people or architects are based and where you're looking at the context from.
Thank you, Tanaya, for your question. I will then first also, as it was proposed by Francisco Moura, introduce myself. My name is Leonid Slanimsky. I'm an architect. I'm the founding partner of Cosmos Architecture Architects. It's an office based between Zurich, Graz, Austria, and Moscow. And we are around 15 people altogether speaking to you now from Zurich, Switzerland, where I teach as well in the University of Art and Design called the HED Geneve. And I mean, maybe I will start answering to your question with a little bit of also continuation of introduction of myself, because actually my partner and Blanca, who's both partner in the office and partner in life, we three decided to start our practice when we moved to Bangkok. And that was also the official beginning of our office. And it was the official, let's say, end of our employment. We worked in Herzog-Demeron all together. And then in order to start our own office and also our research and theoretical work, we have decided to apply to a university there called INDA, Chulalongkorn University.
Yeah, I teach there now.
Great. Yeah, so that was our first step of as independent practice because it allowed us, we were working part-time as professors, that allowed us to get our first experience, teaching academic experience, a first research, and also to start our independent practice, to do some competitions, some projects, which allowed us to kickstart the office. And actually, that's why you also saw quite some pictures in the book, which we shared with you. I will just, because we are doing audio, I will quickly introduce this. This is a book called Temporary Texture, which is a book on which we were working for maybe more than 10 years. So intensively, like publishing, it took us maybe 1 or 2 years to last year's. But the collection of these references and this type of architecture was always a part of our practice. And was also always started as a curiosity and then later turned into our obsession and later turned to our also tool of design, tool of thinking and area of research. And I think that such cities, and actually my first, let's say, big architecture impression was when I went to Tokyo when I was a young student. I was sent there for a semester, exchange semester, as a best in the group, and we had an exchange with Tokyo University. And these two cities, of course, as having a very strong, let's say, radical difference between where I was raised and where I was working at the moment. Respectively, it was Moscow and Basel, and the cities which are also very interesting in architecture, but very different from both Bangkok and Tokyo. I think they left a super strong impression on me personally, but I can also say on our practice because it was not only me in Bangkok. And particularly this notion of temporarity in architecture, which I also actually saw both in all three pieces of which you sent to us. So you sent us a built work, unbuilt work, and a piece of text. Yeah. And all of them in a certain way touch this topic of what is finished architecture, or when is architecture finished? Mm. Is there kind of a state when it's supposed to be complete? Mm. Or is architecture something that is kind of in between moment, is equally important, or the temporary is equally important to the final one? So I think this is, I completely agree with you that that's what we share in common. And to maybe to continue answering your question about like, how would it be? I think that and Bangkok particularly, a rhythm of life and density of construction was really crucial for us to understand many things which are somehow maybe hidden in the, let's say, Central European context, and maybe especially in Switzerland. It's a very different way of constructing, of living, and so on. And actually, I would say that for us, it was an extremely useful experience, which also led us to urban proposal, which we proposed for the city of Basel. So funnily enough, we wanted to make kind of a, let's say, a tribute to the city where we spent more than 5 years and which left. We have, after living 1 year in Bangkok, we have proposed to a certain kind of methods of deregulation of public space in Switzerland. When we formulated that maybe the kind of everything is perfect, but actually nothing is allowed or no one is really happy there. And we made kind of a series of a bit like provocative public space deregulation mechanisms, which later became a part of our series of public projects, which we did. And later it also even became kind of a set of urban principles developed by the city of Basel. But this already came many years later. So I think this kind of learning from the place where you are not, where you are temporary local, but to which you are very foreign, I think is a very important knowledge.
Thank you, Lenny. That's very interesting. We share a lot in common. I mean, I was also living and working in Basel for 1 year after my master's in Japan. So I kind of was influenced from similar, perhaps, cities and sort of the very polar opposites of regulation and unregulation we have here in Bangkok. Right. And then the notion of regulation we have there in Switzerland and perhaps very regulated as well, like in Japan, but something of an in-between, perhaps a more Asian or Eastern way of kind of a more fluid regulation there in Japan, though. I then maybe just one more comment from me, perhaps about going back to your talking about buildings and how they are. We share the same sort of notions of questioning when they're complete and perhaps what is the notions of control and regulation. It brings me to your complete project as well, your built one, the one where you built this kind of very interesting village or different buildings for a community, right? In
Georgia.
In Georgia, exactly, yeah. And I thought that you had proposals for different characteristics and sort of different, very fun and sort of colorful and sometimes buildings of different characters, and they would have different, I would say, functions and inhabitants. And I thought that it would be very nice if I was curious to see sort of how the buildings look now and how the people actually would inhabit them and transform them. I assume that there was kind of like a, always for us as well, there is a kind of dilemma or a balancing between what we design and what we let happen naturally, you know. And I was wondering kind of what decisions you made to design or which part would be color and which part you would design and what part you would let go and what you expect it to transform into.
Mm. Yeah, I think, of course, I would say it's interesting and at the same time, it's of course limiting when you have to present one built work or one unbuilt work. So it was interesting also because it also shows your choice. Not our work can be described by this project, which very specific project. I would say it's quite unique, the whole story of it, the whole story how we got the commission, how we built it, this community. And maybe that's why it was, let's say, for me, it's pleasant to speak about this project because it has lots of, it misses lots of kind of things which a normally designed architectural project or a normal process brings together. So it has lots of also parts of deregulation, parts of, let's say, playfulness, a kind of a very specific client, which actually doesn't act like a real client, which allows you a certain free, like, or a very big creative freedom, while giving you almost a budget, which is almost absent. Mm. And they were even fundraising for each of this project and building it, making it out of construction. So it's basically a project which is all a bit upside down. Of course, in this place, in this Chateau Chapiteau project, for us, it was always important to like, we were a bit in the beginning of, like, how they call it, the kingdom, no? It's founding this kingdom. Of course, it's a kind of ironic name. And now we are already maybe 1 or 2 years not anymore continuing to do them project, and they continue to do themselves. They lead quite actively their social media, and they even invite people to come there to become volunteers and so on, so you can easily find how it's going on. I think what's nice in this kind of setting and in this attitude that no one is considering these projects as, let's say, precious jewelry or works of art which cannot be touched, that you cannot blow on, that everything should be left in these spaces as if it's a museum space, you know, or museified space. And that makes me, of course, happy. Of course, when I see some, let's say, design decisions which are done on the site, which I would never do, which I consider not following our vibe, of course, it makes me a bit said and or kind of thinking, oh, I would do it differently. But at the same time, I think it's quite important to kind of to let go. And especially in this context, no? Mm-hmm. I also remember from your written work that mm-hmm. either you or your partner, Takahiro, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, he says, no, I think it was you who says like, oh, when I was a student, and I was reading these magazines that, how did you say, you were saying that you were reading typically perfect spaces and interiors typically from overseas. I mean, yeah. I guess it was United States and Europe. Yeah. In those pages, nothing was ever out of place. Everything was carefully curated, clean, and concealed. Looking at my surroundings, I didn't resonate with these ideals of beauty, and so on. So basically, I kind of like this point of yours, and I share it, and I find that this needs kind of a development that basically when you design architecture, even if it's a great space, I believe in the fact that it should not be considered like a set in stone perfect space, you know, like exactly like in the images or interiors or spaces which you were describing in this article, in the Spheres article. So I think in a way, this community, I mean, if you saw the images, you saw the people who are doing it, you saw how it's built, I can imagine that it's actually beautiful how life passes there. And even if they break the aesthetics, no, of the, or the aesthetics, the proportions, some certain decisions, I think that that's also the beauty of human life. Mm. I would say that there is a kind of a little anecdote that, for instance, when we were designing, for instance, one of the, like this, what we call tin can castle, like an iron, like corrugated iron chip cabin, kind of an anti-reference for us was the cliche Pinterest, wooden, cozy cabins in the forest, which are usually done all in wood, and they're also cute. And we purposefully wanted to underline the local material, which was the only material which was available from which they do this agriculture construction. And kind of we made it out of metal can, and we even kind of ironized on it in the name that it's, you know, like kind of like when you say you're like sardines in the can, you know, people usually consider it as a negative connotation, no? And here, we tried to turn it into a cozy, nice little house. But we later heard that some people who came there later, they were saying, like, we would like to have the same, but made out of wood. And the tires, which you reused from the local places, we would like to cover them and so on. So it's also interesting to kind of have this reality check of how your ideas or what you find important or, let's say, valuable in your architectural decisions later is not considered as such. And of course, we cannot, like architects, stand next to our buildings all around the planet with an explanatory note and try to explain to people like, oh, you misunderstood me. Our intention was different. No, I think that's normal. And I think that's kind of, that's the beauty and the irony of life. And I kind of I'm always a bit kind of laughing inside myself when I hear kind of the famous modernist maestro masters who kind of get furious when someone is putting something in their masterpiece which was not supposed to be touched, and then they make scandals and so on. For me, I think this is not the way to go, but I may be mistaken. Yeah, maybe. I guess it's maybe my turn to ask you something. I would say that I would start with your built work. And again, I would say that for me, maybe the most interesting notion would be this kind of purposeful feeling of not being complete. Let's call it like this. I don't know, maybe there's one word which can describe this. I'm as you maybe saw also in our in some of our projects or in some of our lectures presentations, we are quite fascinated by the structures which you have managed and by the feeling which you have managed to achieve in the project called House K completed, which to me it looks, I mean, I don't know, it can sound like both as a compliment as a criticism. It looks like an unfinished construction, and sometimes we my partner, he remembers the name, there is a certain specific term, I will look for it later, a Greek phenomenon of incomplete structures, where it has to do with basically if you leave the building unfinished and you do it by leaving the concrete kind of pillars with the rebar metal sticking out of the roof, therefore your home is not taxated. So in many places in Greece, you can see this buildings where people live for many years, but they have this kind of feeling of a construction site, and this is done due to the to this law. I don't know how actual is this information, but this phenomenon was always as a feeling for me of this beautiful. It was always a beautiful inspiration, and for me, your house gate looks a little bit like this, with kind of inserted two or three elements, which give this brutal kind of unbuilt ruin a very a touch of a for a work of art or of a very cozy house, like this curtain, the fine little balustrade, the big tilted window. And I really appreciate this kind of the mix between this unfinished, let's say, brutality of this, let's call it hardware of the bones of the building, and kind of a very refined and very elegant kind of elements with which the human is interacting. So maybe you could a bit explain how did you come to this? And that would be one question. And also, what is the, I would say that architectural obsession with such aesthetics is usually not shared by the clients. And I can imagine, I don't know, 90 out of 100 clients would say, why is the house not finished? Why there's no stucco? Why does it look like it's still in construction? So the second question would be, how do you, or especially with this house, what was the reaction both of clients, of people who live on the street, of your, I don't know, friends who are not architects?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's a kind of very good, I think, observation. I think I've heard of these taxation laws in Greece as well, and I think it's the same in Nepal. And Kathmandu, a lot of buildings are left unfinished, and people start to live on the bottom floor because they don't want to pay the taxes of the building being finished. I mean, that was kind of several years ago. But I think with this house, I think us practicing in Thailand now, you know, post-COVID, similar to a lot of younger firms in other countries, I think we're going through an economy where less and less people can afford to build a single home. And with that said, for us, we are challenged with a lot of low to medium budget projects and trying to achieve a lot within a tight budget or a small plot. And with that said, our kind of strategy is to always talk about what the building can be, but not having to fulfill every single requirement or need from the beginning, because that's impossible. And we start off always with all of our buildings, not only this specific house, but with all of our buildings which have a sense of perhaps unfinished or continuation or open-ended possibilities, is to say that, hey, maybe you can keep some of these alterations or modifications for the future, but let's start with something that could provide that canvas or that possibility for you in the future. And I think that's always how we start. When the talk is not only about aesthetics, but it's about space and possibility and money and for them to expand in the future, I think it's always more convincing for the client to come to this idea of, you know, a kind of house that's ongoing. But also with this house, we were lucky to have a client who was kind of coming from an interior architecture or an architecture background or an art background. So he had a very good sense of possibilities and could imagine and connect the dots of what structures could become or what could, you know, he could do with the spaces in the future. And I think kind of we had several workshops and different kind of a very close always relationship with our clients, just to make sure that they kind of understand what they are getting into. And always, I think with them moving in after, I think we oftentimes, I think usually, you know, if the relationship is still good and they're still open for us to go in, which hopefully is most of the time, we would go in and to see how they would adapt and live in the house and how they kind of modify and extend the spaces and talk about what they could do with spaces in the future. And I think with this house, I think we didn't start exactly off with the idea of kind of let's make a brutal looking building or something very raw, but this was one of our first projects when we started the office, but we wanted to use whatever was available in Bangkok. So what is the most common or the most typical way of building here, which is what you see, and of course you've seen a lot of those when you were here, but kind of RC, post and beam buildings with brick infill. But instead of covering it up, we thought, how can we just kind of eliminate the cost of all of this cladding and show whatever is inside, but beautifully, and then just make a building that is kind of showing whatever inside of all of the other buildings and, you know, call that a home rather than trying to cover it up. And then we kind of inserted softer elements, as you said, like curtains or handrails or these kind of infills that we, you call it perhaps software, and we call it just, you know, other elements of different timelines, I guess we would call it. And to suggest that kind of these elements are on a different timeline or different shifting or kind of different kind of a sphere or meaning within the building. So you have different shiftings of elements that could potentially be removed or adjusted in the future as well. And and then just, you know, the building was finished and the client started to move in, but the neighbors still suspected that it wasn't finished. And we had lots of stares and people staring at the building for a while for the first year when it was done in the neighborhood. Yeah.
Just a technical question. How is it, is there for such a scale of a building, is there a building permit necessary in Bangkok or not?
Yes, in Bangkok, there is a building permit necessary if you're building anything over, I think, 150 square meters or two stories. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it was the permit was necessary. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's an interesting building for me. But maybe one question for me, it's both very local, like Bangkok building, but it's at the same time very global, or very, it could have been if not the wires on the picture and the tropical plants next to it and certain other details which I kind of already recognized from Bangkok. It could have been a building in another context, and maybe that brings me to another question or another kind of point of let's say a critique slash interrogation. Do you at all discuss this kind of idea or intention of being local, vernacular, site specific, and so on, or you believe in the fact that this should not be pushed, otherwise it becomes kind of a kitsch or a pastiche thing, and it comes naturally from, let's say, from basically the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, of this place where you are, and you don't need to artificially, let's say, make it more Thai or more Japanese than you already guys are.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
Debates in the office.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the time we don't keep in mind the idea of trying to make it a certain Thai-ness or Japanese or anything. I think it just comes naturally from our backgrounds, but definitely, we want to make buildings or architecture that are intentionally very universal. And we don't, although we work very contextually, you know, we work whatever on the context that is available or that is accessible or that is cheap sometimes. But that kind of process in itself, we believe, makes the building universal. So rather than working something with very, very specific and saying that this building is a notion that could have been only done here in Thailand or in Japan, we feel that that notion of using whatever we have or using whatever is accessible is something that we all share together. And for us, that's very, very important to make buildings that could be replicated. The idea could be replicated elsewhere, but perhaps looking a bit different or utilizing other materials. But the notion of accessibility and openness should always be there. And I think with a lot of the way we make, I think if with your experience in Thailand, you would know that labor here is still kind of very affordable. So, you know, we can afford to build things by hand and doing things that are a bit more labor intensive as opposed to Japan or Europe. However, we don't intentionally talk about that. We don't want to rely on kind of low cost labor to do anything labor intensive just to show design or showing that that is a kind of romanticization of perhaps a kind of underdeveloped construction industry or something like that. We want to talk about architecture that is something that's very universal. So definitely, as you said, we do not intentionally want to talk about our buildings as something that is perhaps very, very contextual in that way.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that I think that these things really come from the context naturally. And even if you take the same ingredients, in terms of, I don't know, shape and material and proportion applied to a different context, it naturally becomes local. I was actually wanted to ask, you know, this, I think it was quite an old project by All Zone Architects, which was a kind of a speculative renovation of abandoned Bangkok parking garages.
Yes, I've seen that project, I think. Kind of like
when they made like a little mini houses, no, inside. And yeah, we use it also quite often as a like a reference of this notion, what we discussed of this hardware and software, of these two kind of I mean, there's of course much more layers to architecture, but in principle, kind of dichotomy between the kind of more permanent and more, let's say, long-lasting bones, the hardware of the building, and kind of the ways how people occupy this building. I think what I find particularly interesting in your projects is, and now I'm not only speaking about House A, but also some other projects of yours, which I have had a chance to look at, is this notion of kind of feeling that some of your projects, it's almost hard to say whether it's a intentionally new construction or whether it's a ruin or an existing structure which is occupied by the users. I find this particularly beautiful and also very, very relevant for contemporary practice when I think that, again, coming to the, let's say, finished and unfinished architecture, that I personally believe that it's very important to make buildings which allow for a natural flow of future inhabitants, users, to adapt their buildings to new program, new climate, new economic conditions, growth of the family, new challenges, new crisis, maybe shrinking of the family. And can you say a couple of words of how do you achieve this feeling? I mean, so it's hard for me to say in which project I see this, because I think on your website, the projects are not all kind of marked with the names, but I guess you know what I mean, no?
Yes, no, I understand. Yeah, I think that's, for us, like, similarly to what I've seen in your work and in your written work as well, the notion of time is very important. And for us, the notion of sustainability comes through understanding an extension of time of buildings themselves, right? And then the extension of buildings, time of buildings, doesn't mean preserving the buildings in the way they are, but understanding that life changes and you have to let go and you have to let things be and allow buildings to afford and let people live or adapt through time. Mm-hmm. So intentionally, we always make things looking a bit separate, like they weren't designed at the same time or not designed together. Like you will see, like in a lot of attempts, a span doesn't fit the size of the room and we kind of extend it outside of the span intentionally. Mm-hmm. And because we don't feel that structure has to serve one function and functions change, and structures such as concrete, for sure, which is the cheapest way to build at the moment in Thailand, should last for at least 50 to 60 years. But functions last for only 10 to 15 years, or in your project, maybe 1 month, right? Or 1 day or a few weeks, and then it changes. So that kind of overlapping of different functions, we try to understand and kind of deliberately kind of shift them within architecture from the beginning to suggest that, hey, you know, it's okay to break certain rules and it's okay to be shifted and open up this kind of conversation of the building itself to the idea of maybe it's okay that everything doesn't look completely together or completely new or completely designed, but it's still one ecosystem that you can build upon or extend or live for or grow with. And that also comes to kind of the conversation of kind of Bangkok city itself, you know, and the dilemma of us walking to the city and we sometimes find something that's super anonymous that we think it's so beautiful and so interesting, as opposed to something that was designed or built by an architect, sometimes by ourselves, that we feel are terrible designs and we don't like this at all. We'd be free for something that's super anonymous. And because of that notion itself, we think there must be something wrong with kind of the profession of architecture and how we are approaching it. And with that said, you know, I'm also criticizing myself or our practice at the same time, kind of the contemporary practice in general, that it's more and more, it's shifting towards this kind of anonymity or kind of vernacularity, or perhaps like industrial vernacularity in a way. I think this is all over the world. And with our projects, the hardest thing is fighting against our urge to design or kind of control or setting up too many rules or making too many architectural decisions. And we kind of try to step back from that, and sometimes doing something a bit silly or sometimes doesn't seem very well thought through is giving the building a kind of softness or allowing things to happen spontaneously in the future. Sometimes within our buildings, especially in our more temporary projects like pavilions, we try to achieve a kind of walk on the fine line between maybe the building was kind of naturally erected by somebody who is in the city or designed by an architect. So we kind of try to navigate this kind of gray line between professional and non-professional, which is, I think, the hardest part of being a professional, is to kind of get rid of that training, 10 years and many years of training and thought that we've been instilled with, you know, through our entire profession, I think.
I think it's, I completely share your view in this sense, because we are also currently conducting a research project which is called First Reuse, and it also has a lot of cases from global cases of people reusing buildings, elements, objects, and spaces without the intention of patrimonial intention, ecological intention. They're usually doing it out of crisis, out of scarcity, poverty. Sometimes we speak about refugees, sometimes we speak about war zones, sometimes we just simply speak about societies where the regulations are currently not working very very well or of the context. And it's incredibly, sometimes it's incredibly mind-blowing and experimental, the works which we see in these cases. And the most of them are done, or 100% in this research, are done by non-professional architects, non-trained architects, or not even consider themselves architects, very far from maybe this a bit pejorative Rudovsky attitude, like we are pedigreed architects and they are non-pedigreed architects. We are very far away from this kind of pejorative attitude to this phenomenon. We think it's the opposite, that we are maybe, we are as a profession bound by conventions, by the standards of construction industry, by the Neufert norms, by the money, by the contracts, insurance companies, and so on. And we cannot allow this kind of freedom of expression, which is sometimes extremely beautiful. It really comes from necessity. It never is using anything which we shouldn't have, which is just done out of being pretentious or being show off. Yeah, I think it's a very, it's really, really inspiring. And for me, yeah, Bangkok in particular was a place where these type of buildings are really everywhere. And and therefore I think that the place where you work is very, yeah, it's really a place of which can bring understanding that such attitude architecture can work. I also would say that this notion of time also allows you to experiment much more. Because if you know that you kind of built for centuries, you have this on your shoulders, you kind of think so much, you overthink and so on. And if you think this is just a scaffolding, you know, it will last for a couple of weeks, which in the end is not true. In the end, it can stay there for 10 years, as we know. There's nothing more permanent than temporary things, but it stays there and the architect pushes or the builder pushes to the limits, you know, and makes something extremely impressive.
No, this is definitely, I think about this kind of every day within our practice. And we ask ourselves about kind of the future of Bangkok and of the region as well, and what it means to be developed or developing, or does it mean that we have to be more regulated? Where are we headed? And I think it's an answer that I cannot answer, but it's something that we need to address soon before it's, you know, too late and we lose this sense of freedom or a sense of fluidity that is kind of so, I think, important to the city and kind of sustainability itself as well. Yeah, but I do not have an answer for that. For where should we should be headed? But definitely, I don't think more regulation is the answer. But regulation is also important, of course. Safety and, you know, and everything. Engineering is very, very important. Yeah, I think it's something that we have to really think about.
I think somehow we naturally, I think we kind of came to a nice, interesting conclusion.